Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, a way of soaking up just oil from water. We'll find out how. And the works of Shakespeare have been translated into DNA. But why? Plus, a new technique that can turn waste into watts.
We generally get chemical yields over 80%, which is a reasonable accomplishment. I don't know of any other process which gives organic products directly from cellulosic materials in comparable yield.
And chemist Mark Maskell joins us shortly to explain how that system works.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and also with us for this, the March 2013 edition of Chemistry World, are Phil Robinson, Ian Farrell and Andrew Turley. And up first, marshmallows that can soak up an oil slick on water. Andrew.
Well, it's not traditional marshmallow, it's not the ones you'd want to eat, but these scientists from Kyoto University, Kazuyoshi Kanemori and colleagues, have devised a kind of gel that works a bit like a marshmallow, or responds a bit like a marshmallow when you prod it, and more importantly, though, it can separate oil from water.
Really? How does it do that?
Well, it is very hydrophobic, is the key element. And also, it's very flexible. So you need something that's going to spring back into shape after you've used it and wrung the oil out so that it can be reused later down the
line. So it's an oil-specific J-cloth, effectively?
Essentially, yes. You dip it into a mixture of oil and water repeatedly, and it will only pull out the oil. It's incredibly hydrophobic. The polymer they use is called PMSQ, which I won't try and say out because it's very long and very complicated.
What's in it?
So the polymer, the base of the polymer is silicon. So it's got, rather than lots of carbons, it's got lots of silicon atoms in it, and these bound to methyl groups makes for a very hydrophobic
which is why
material.
It loves the oil.
Yeah, so it's not so much that it needs to love the oil, it's actually that it needs to repel very strongly the water, because the structure of the material will inherently absorb things. It's got a, you know, just like your bath sponge or something like that, it's got these gaps in it, these pores that will suck up liquids.
Have they tested it?
They have tested it. They've tested it with water and an oil called hexane, which is a bit like the oil you might have if you spill oil in the sea, crude oil. And it works remarkably well. If you go to our website, you can see a very fine video of this in action.
But you say hexane, but crude oil is quite different from hexane, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot more in crude oil. So have they tested it with crude oil?
They haven't tested it with crude oil yet. Crude oil is actually a very complicated product. As you say, it's got a lot of different things in, and often, you know, you don't know exactly the composition. And so that's the challenge. What they have done is tested it under very harsh conditions. So they've tested it from 300 to minus 196 degrees C to check that you could use it anywhere in the world and under a range of conditions. And they've also been keen to talk about the other things you might do with it. So that's a very high-profile application to separate crude oil from water, as in an oil spill. But there's all sorts of environments in which you want to separate different phases. Oil and water is a classic one.
Well, the kitchen.
The kitchen, exactly.
You want to get the oil off the gravy. But chemists do a lot of this sort of work when they're doing various reactions, and you might want to have one phase and get it away from the other phase.
Absolutely. They're always doing that kind of work. And something that's going to be reusable is going to be very important.
Thanks, Andrew. OK, well, let's move gears a bit and talk about spectroscopy, Phil. And scientists have come up with a way that we could use a spectrophotometer, perhaps, or a mass spectrometer, to work out whether someone is immersed in some rubble.
That's quite right, Chris. When disaster strikes, the costs in terms of life can be enormous. And when these events happen, one of the critical things that needs to take place is to identify as quickly as possible if there are people trapped within any rubble of buildings and so forth, and whether or not they're alive, so that you can start trying to rescue them as quickly as possible.
Because the way that this is traditionally done is to bring in an army of sniffer dogs, isn't it? Or to do thermal imaging and look for hot spots where there might be people.
Exactly, exactly. So dogs are extremely good. They have very sensitive noses, so they can be trained to sniff out humans in the rubble. And of course, thermal imaging can also pick up the heat signatures of people who are trapped in the rubble. But these are not perfect solutions. Dogs need to rest. They can become confused when there are many bodies around them. It's difficult for them to tell exactly where they are.
Also, if a person is alive or dead, I suppose.
Exactly, and that is where this research comes in. So Wolfgang Wotz at the Leibniz Institute for Analytical Chemistry in Germany has developed a complementary technique that could be used alongside sniffer dogs and thermal imaging to help identify whether or not victims, trapped victims, are alive or dead. The technique that he uses is a variation of mass spectroscopy, so it's gas chromatography mass spectrometry, separating the different components of a sample and then identifying them using mass spectrometry.
So how does it work? You go to the notional disaster area and stick a probe into the rubble or something, collect out a sample of the gas, the headspace that's there, and feed that into the apparatus and see if a certain cocktail of chemicals is there?
That's basically how they imagined that it would work. Of course, in this case, we're talking about proof of concept, so this is very early stage of proving that it would be possible to do such tests. So the experiment that they've actually carried out is to put some of their graduate students into a room for a number of hours, and over the course of that time, they extract samples of the air and identified by looking at a number of different participants the signatures that are common to all humans. Effectively, they come up with 12 analytes that can be used to indicate the presence of a live person,
a viable person. And so by comparing the fingerprint that comes out of rubble, for instance, with that spectrum, you could say, well, it looks like there is a live person.
Exactly, yes.
Because the same thing's being used for disease detection, isn't it? I mean, I've been talking to various scientists who work on a similar sort of thing to look for cancers, for example, using exhaled breath.
True, very true.
Now, the person I spoke with who told me he was doing that, the devices he was using were room-sized. I mean, they weren't the kind of thing you could easily transport to an earthquake zone. How do this group propose to get around that?
So they haven't either. They do have a miniature version, but a miniature GCMS is still a pretty big piece of kit. This is about 25 kilos. It is pretty difficult. So that would be one of the key components in making this a reality, is shrinking the size of that instrument down to something a little more portable.
Phil Robinson. And now to the question of how will we fuel the future? Mark Maskell.
There are issues that are at stake with the petroleum economy. One of them is energy. But energy, there's a lot of different modalities that can be used. Solar, I think we all know, wind, ocean energy, these kinds of things. But when it comes to materials, you can't make plastics, for example, that are normally made from petroleum out of wind or sunshine, right? You need biomass. And the same thing with transportation fuels. Some things only work really well on fuels, for example, jets and heavy construction equipment. You're not going to run those on fuel cells or batteries. Biomass conversion has become an important topic in science today.
What do we define as biomass?
When we talk about that, we're generally speaking about plant matter, mainly carbohydrates. Most often we're talking about cellulose and hemicellulose, which are large sugar-based molecules. There's also lignin and various other extractives, but the carbohydrates have been the typical target of most technologies.
So what's the problem with turning those materials into something we can use?
It's a fairly substantial challenge to do this cheaply and efficiently. And there are really three methods that have emerged. The principal one that you see today is a microbial method using fermentation. So you break your carbohydrates into sugars and then you ferment them into some simple material, usually an organic alcohol or acid. Ethanol is a very typical one. You can also use pyrolytic methods. So you heat these things up to really high temperatures and you end up with a mixture of gases and liquids and char, which can be mined for specific uses as fuels. Although these, it gives you a pretty wild mixture of materials, which need to be upgraded if you're going to use them for most purposes. And then you have the area I work in, which is basically just using chemical catalytic methods to convert these into useful molecules.
Chemically. Do you have any molecules in mind that would be a good platform chemical to start with?
The ones that have emerged from the chemical catalytic pathway have basically been based on the furan framework, which is a five-membered ring with an oxygen in it, or another one that's related to that called the levulinate platform, which is a fairly simple chain molecule, so five-carbon chain with a couple of functionalities in there that can be exploited.
Why have you picked on those?
Those are the ones that are most easily accessible, and they are ones also that you can imagine a large number of derivatives that could be useful renewable replacements for petroleum products coming from.
And the crucial question, of course, how do we make them efficiently in the first place?
So our approach is something that generates mainly the furanic platform, from which the levulinate platform can also be accessed. And what we do is we take biomass. So it can be any type of biomass as long as it has carbohydrates in it. It can be sugars. It could be starch. But most usefully, it could be cellulose or cellulose-containing materials. And we put it into a reactor that has two phases. It has a water phase and it has an organic solvent phase. And that water phase contains an acid which breaks down the long chains of carbohydrates that make up cellulose and breaks that down into sugars. And it also converts that sugar into this furan-type material. But the trick here is that furan material is something which is traditionally quite unstable and then can continue when it's processed with acid to give stuff that you really don't want, really sort of garbage, really. And the organic phase is something which, when it's present, can sweep the material that you make into that phase and keep it safe. So if it's sequestered into that organic phase, it doesn't decompose further. And that's the kind of basis of the reactor that we have developed.
What sort of yield can you get out of this?
We generally get chemical yields over 80%, which is a reasonable accomplishment. I don't know of any other process which gives organic products directly from cellulosic materials in comparable yield.
What's left over afterwards?
So it depends on what you start with, but if you start, for example, let's say with forestry waste, we're doing a project now where we're working on some sawdust that a paper company has provided for us. You end up with a leftover that is the lignin that isn't converted in this process. So that can be 25, 30, or more even percent of the mass of the of the material that you put in.
It's basically the woody stuff, isn't it? It's what makes wood, wood.
Yeah. So wood is, of course, it's a combination of cellulose and lignin, really, and some hemicellulose, too, which is also a kind of a sugar material. And so the lignin is left over in the end. But we've got some interesting projects to use that lignin as well, because it's a very, very clean lignin that we get out of this. It's ash-free material that we're also interested in exploiting.
Putting the numbers down, how much energy do you think actually we could, if we adopted your strategy, how much energy and useful material could we produce via this route?
Yeah, so the entire process, if you put it all together, you get an interesting outcome in a way, because really you're using all of the components of biomass to their maximum extent, and that's potentially an interesting basis for a business. And indeed, there have been a couple of companies that have decided to commercialize this technology.
UC Davis's Mark Maskell. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, the works of Shakespeare written into DNA, and why the way things smell might be more about the way they vibrate than the actual shapes of the molecules. Before that, though, how sea urchins have shown scientists a trick or two that can turn carbon dioxide into carbonates. And it's all down to nickel nanoparticles. Ian?
Well, sea urchins, it turns out, provide a bit of inspiration in how we might deal with excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is the much touted carbon capture and storage, CCS, which involves taking carbon dioxide from industrial processes or power plants before it gets into the atmosphere, turning it into something that's more storable. Something like calcium carbonate is good. And it turns out that calcium carbonate is actually what sea urchins make their exoskeletons from. It's in eggshells. It's quite abundant in nature. So some researchers at the University of Newcastle, Gaurav Badari and Lydia Silla, noticed that there are nickel ions on the surface of sea urchin larvae, and they took a cue from this to try and use nickel nanoparticles to turn carbon dioxide into carbonic acid, which is the first part in this process.
So they assumed that those nickel ions are there, playing a key role in whatever this fixation process is of turning presumably dissolved CO2 then into carbonic acid and then into the carbonate or the bicarbonate initially.
That's absolutely right, yes. And at the moment we can do that using amines as a catalyst or an enzyme, carbonic anhydrase. But both those methods have got problems. The amines are not very efficient and the carbonic anhydrase is very fussy and pH sensitive. The nickel nanoparticles do it much, much better.
So how easy actually is this to do? Because it's one thing to knock up some nanoparticles in the lab. It's another to say, and this will be industrially viable. So what's the approach here?
One of the big advantages of this nickel nanoparticle approach is they're totally recyclable and really easy to separate from the reaction mixture because, of course, nickel's magnetic. So in theory, all one has to do to get the catalyst back is sweep a big magnet over the reaction mixture and out pops the catalyst.
So the idea would be that instead of having to put carbon scrubbers in the form of these amines in power stations and things, you could potentially have these sorts of nanoparticle arrangements pass the CO2 through, and you grow a sea urchin in your power station.
Yeah,
what are you
going
to do
right.
with all this calcium carbonate?
Well, it's much easier to store than a gas because it's more dense. So I guess that's for politicians to decide how we then go on and store that stuff for years to come.
OK, well, it's one to think about, isn't it? Andrew, talking about things to think about, Shakespeare, and not Shakespeare in love so much as Shakespeare in DNA.
Yes, Shakespeare can be put into DNA. DNA is well known as the biological data storage material, and it works very, very well.
It's pretty resilient, isn't it? And you think we're reading the DNA genomes of animals that have been dead for thousands of years. We can't even read the CD that I wrote on my computer 10 years ago or the floppy disk I had 15 years ago.
Right. You know, you can dig up ice cores, million-year-old DNA, and it's still viable. It can still be read. The data can still be read off it. So can we use this for our own purposes? And Nick Goldman at the European Bioinformatics Institute and his colleagues think very much so you can. What they've been able to do, amazingly, is put all of Shakespeare's sonnets into DNA. They digitized it first, but it's all there, it's all perfectly readable and stored for a very long time.
Well, let's just talk through the method then. So you start with some of Shakespeare's writing. It was always totally incomprehensible to me when I was at school, but that's by the by. How do you convert the words of Shakespeare into something that becomes DNA? Because obviously the DNA alphabet has only got four letters, A, C, T and G, whereas Shakespeare had enormous vocabulary and 26 letters to play with.
Yes, so the things don't match up very well. So these guys took the route of turning it into binary code first. So if you think about doublets, putting those bases together, there's four different ways you might put 1 and 0 together. 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 1. And handily, you've got four bases. So as that is your sort of basis, you can then digitize the information. And once you've done that, that opens up the traditional data storage approach that we all use, computers and iPhones and all the rest.
Did they make one enormous DNA molecule, or was the work carved up into lots of little molecules?
The second one, they carved it up into little pieces. So you've got to have sort of connecting sections that explain how these strands, how they relate to each other.
Their address, I suppose.
It's something akin to an address, yes. But it's all very doable. It's not convenient to have one long strand for lots of reasons. It's not very easily manipulated. So better to have these little sections. One of the key things they had to do, though, within these little sections is avoid homopolymers. So the one bit where they struggle to read things is where you have lots and lots of repeat units. So lots of A's all together. And so you have to come up with a system that avoids that.
Because that's more error-prone or harder to read, isn't it? When you feed it through the reader, it's more likely to stumble over lots of repeated letters of the same type.
Yeah, so you're working with biological systems, and they have certain idiosyncrasies. And one of those is that lots of repeating units causes the reader's problems, yeah.
What's the point of using DNA like this, though? Are there not better molecules? Or is this just a starting point?
Well, yes, there may well be better molecules. DNA provides a very good starting point, and this is using DNA in its raw form. It may well be that we can refine the DNA or use perhaps a different biopolymer, a protein of some kind. There's all sorts of different of ways we might tweak this, but DNA is robust. We know it works because it works inside all of biological material, and so it provides a great place to start.
Andrew Turley. The London Olympics was a major highlight for the UK in 2012. But beyond the boost that sports and athletics received, there's also been a healthy scientific legacy too. And that's because the state-of-the-art laboratory that delivered the drug testing services for the Games now has a new lease of life as the Phenome Centre, where the latest technology is enabling scientists to marry up the metabolomics of an individual, and you'll find out what that means in a second, with a disease process. John Linden.
The aim of these phenome centres is to use advanced analytical methodology in an untargeted fashion to look at all the body's biochemistry in the clinical situation, in human samples, as I say, mostly in urine or blood plasma. And one centre, which is based at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington, will look at individual patients as they come into the hospital, as they are diagnosed, as they undergo treatment, as they undergo rehabilitation or whatever happens to them when they go home. And we're hoping to look at how their biochemistry changes during this process, this patient journey, as we say, to improve clinical diagnosis, but very importantly, to improve prognosis, to improve how we can predict the outcome or what will happen to that person. Part of that is, of course, finding the right drug at the right time, at the right person, because not every person reacts to a drug in exactly the same way. Some people get a lot of benefit and some people actually have adverse effects.
So it would be very nice to know which drug to give which person. What are you actually going to use or measure in making those assessments?
We're going to use, as I said, some sort of advanced analytical chemistry instrumentation. And there are two main ones that we use most of the time because they give us lots of information, not only on how much of a particular substance is in the urine or the blood, but exactly what the nature of that molecule is. We can identify it using these techniques. And these techniques enable us to look at hundreds and thousands of molecules at the same time in an untargeted fashion. We use something called nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR spectroscopy, which looks at the hydrogens in the molecules. And then we also use mass spectrometry. For mass spectrometry, there's an additional complication in that we have to separate the molecules first, and we use a particular form of separation technology called chromatography or ultra-performance liquid chromatography. We're going to use both of these techniques in both Phenome centres. The new Phenome centre that has been announced recently, which will be based at the Hammersmith Hospital, which is not to look at individual patients, but to huge cohorts of samples from patients from studies collected in the field, so-called epidemiology studies.
What sorts of patient samples will you be putting into this analytical system?
Mostly it will be urine. It will also predominantly be serum or blood plasma. The two, as far as we're concerned, are essentially indistinguishable. But for specialist situations, we can also look at other sorts of body fluids as well. So, for example, neurological conditions, we might look at cerebrospinal fluid. for, say, reproductive conditions. We might look at male seminal fluid or female amniotic fluid, for example.
So you will get enormous amounts of patient material, and you will effectively generate a huge number of analytes or levels of all these chemicals and metabolites that are present. How are you going to marry those up with what's wrong with the actual person or what happened to the person in hospital, which drug they received, what treatment algorithms they went through and so on, so that you can begin to unite what metabolic profiles they had with what you did to them?
Yes, this is the needle in the haystack, of course. Many of these situations, we'll have cases and controls, and then we will have a gold standard diagnosis by some other technique. And to sift through these many, many thousands and thousands of numbers and thousands of samples, we need to use advanced computational methods, of course, to pin down on those few metabolites, those few compounds in the sample, which are the distinguishing features between the classes. And the more patients that we study, the bigger the database we will build up. And then we can interrogate that database retrospectively, of course, to look for prognostic markers.
Yeah, so the idea being that if I turn up and I have, say, a lung cancer, and I have a certain spectrum of markers, A, you'll be able to identify, are there certain markers that reproducibly, say, are there in lung cancers, but also markers which, according to perhaps their level or the unique combination of markers, co-segregate or go along with a lung cancer that has a better prognosis, or a lung cancer that will respond really well to drug X versus drug Y.
Indeed. Of course, any new tests that come out of this research, these new tests have to be translatable into patients. So this has to be something that could be useful within about 3 years' time.
Now, one of the things that, I mean, this offers the opportunity of being able to deliver is that a pharmaceutical company could have a drug which will work very well in a subset of patients who have a certain subset of a certain kind of disease. Problem is it going to be economically viable for a pharmaceutical company to develop a drug just for that minority subset? Because at the moment, they make all their money by making a drug which everyone tries on everything.
Yes. One of the reasons the pharmaceutical industry invested so heavily in genetic profiling, genomics and transcriptomics, gene transcript profiling, was because they wanted to target their drugs at the right patients that would show the most benefit. We believe that metabolomics gives them a new opportunity to do that, in fact, because the metabolic processes we are observing are a result of both our genes and our environment. So we can look at environmental effects as well as genetic effects. So in that sense, metabolomics would offer perhaps a bigger picture than the genetic approach.
I presume that means that they would then be offering their drugs to people who need them or will do better on them, and this means you'll also minimise side effects.
Exactly. I'm sure the drug industry is very interested in making certain they target their drug at the best patient population for that drug.
How long do you think it'll be before we see tangible fruit being borne by this enterprise?
Well, I think there will be some areas of disease where we will see effects very, very quickly. Some specialist areas of disease, perhaps, like inborn errors of metabolism, single gene defects.
Are you collecting sufficiently rich data from the patients so that you can also begin to say, well, not just we're interested in the disease X that you've got, but also what diet you've eaten across your lifetime and how many cigarettes you smoked, how much alcohol you've drunk and so on, so you can also do some really important epidemiology more generally?
Indeed, one can. And, for example, there is a paper published in the last couple of years where taking a cohort of subjects from across the world, all those subjects had their blood pressure measured, and we could then find metabolic markers that would link to hypertension. And so this is done without any preconception, without any hypothesis beforehand. You can go and look into the data in that way. One of the things we're doing in the clinical centre, of course, we'll be looking at surgical patients. And surgical patients come into the hospital with a whole range of coexisting factors. They may be malnourished, they may be obese, they may have other diseases such as diabetes or cardiovascular problems. And so we have to be able to disentangle all those things.
John Lyndon from Imperial College London. And now, why a smell might be more about the way the molecules vibrate than their physical shapes. Phil.
Well, this story is all about smell, but more precisely, how our sense of smell works, which you may or may not know, is not terribly well understood. As we understand things at the moment, in order for us to smell something, the molecule that makes that smell, the odorant molecule, will make its way into your nose. It will bind to a receptor in your nose, an olfactory receptor, and that will create some signal that goes to your brain and tells you that you're smelling something.
Right.
Now, that's all well and good, and it fits very nicely with the standard model for biomolecular interactions. The molecule has some shape, the receptor has a complementary shape, the two recognise one another effectively. You have a shape recognition, the lock and key mechanism, as it's known, and so the two will come together. The receptor recognises the molecule.
So what's the fly in the ointment then?
The fly in the ointment is that not all molecules of the same shape have the same smell, and not all molecules with the same smell have the same shape.
Oh.
So you can have two molecules with very different shapes that have the same smell.
Yes.
But equally, you can have two molecules with very similar shapes that have different smells.
So clearly something else is going on as well.
There must be something else there that we don't understand, which is where Luca Turin of the Alexander Fleming Research Centre in Greece comes in with his controversial theory of what that missing part might be.
So what does he say?
Well, he says, discard the idea of shape recognition, effectively. It's got nothing to do with it. What a receptor is recognising when it binds to one of these molecules is, in fact, the vibrations of the molecule. The bonds of a molecule, the connections between the atoms, they are not static, they vibrate, they move back and forth. And those vibrations, he proposes, are recognised by the receptor when it binds the molecule, and that's what it's responding to.
What's his evidence then to support that?
So what he's done in this case is to use deuteration. So that involves replacing the hydrogen atoms in a molecule with deuterium atoms,
which are twice as heavy.
Exactly.
So they're going to vibrate at a different rate, aren't they?
That is exactly the principle that he's employed. If you have a heavier atom in the molecule, then the bond to which it belongs will have a different vibrational frequency than it did when it was bonded to hydrogen.
It should be lower, shouldn't it? Because heavier things will bounce more slowly.
Yes, so you have a slower frequency.
He's got a molecule then which is full of deuterium rather than hydrogen, so it's a heavier molecule with a different vibrational frequency. Has he done that experiment?
That is precisely what he's done. So he takes an odorant molecule, a molecule with a musky smell, and he systematically replaces the hydrogen atoms in there. There are some 20-odd hydrogen atoms that he can replace, and he finds that actually when you replace about half of those hydrogen atoms with deuterium, people who are smelling these scents begin to notice a difference. They say that the smell gets more burnt, it gets muskier.
Wow. What do other scientists say about this?
When it comes to naysayers, there's pretty much nothing but naysayers. he's kind of out on his own here with this idea. So other scientists have said the evidence looks reasonable, but there are lots of other things that could be going on. The way in which the samples have been prepared could have changed the samples, they say. Probably the only way to convince people is to actually monitor that electrical signal that occurs when the deuterated molecule binds to the receptor and show that there's a difference between the two cases of deuteration and non-deuteration.
Wow, Phil, thank you. Well, sticking with something which is extremely small, but perhaps even smaller, I don't know, Ian, printing drugs with an inkjet printer. How's this work?
That's right. Well, what inkjet printers are really, really good at is creating fantastically small droplets of liquid and putting them down with extreme precision. And Simon Gaisford from the UCL School of Pharmacy has used this not to print with ink like you might do if you're printing photographs or text, but to print with solutions of drugs to try and make co-crystals.
What's a co-crystal?
So a co-crystal is a crystalline substance that comprises of two different molecules that form the unit cell that repeats inside the crystal. And it may be that both of these substances can crystallise perfectly happily by themselves, but they can also crystallise together. When they do this, they give a unique set of physical properties.
Which, in the case of a drug, is presumably very important for the action of the drug.
That's right.
So getting that crystal architecture right in order to understand what the drug's doing is 100% of the game.
That's right. So the properties you might be after, you might be trying to fine-tune solubility, which is all about making the drug biologically available to to the systems inside your body.
So how do scientists do this at the moment? If they want a co-crystal, would they actually physically have to grow it then?
Yeah, absolutely.
And presumably getting consistent crystals to do serial assays on must also be very difficult if you've got to laboriously grow them all.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So where does the inkjet printer come in then?
Well, by putting different solutions in the chambers of an empty inkjet cartridge, which presumably they've cleaned out very well, a pass of the printhead across some medium like paper or film means that you can deposit two different solutions on top of each other in very, very small volumes. And because the volume's so small, the solvent evaporates very quickly. And these guys have said they see the existence of a co-crystal after just one pass of the inkjet head across the film.
Is it a useful amount of material, though?
No. They say they have to wait for five passes in order to characterise what's there. And after 10 passes, they say they have the sort of optimal amount of crystal that they're going to get.
So just this drug or other agents as well, do you think?
No, I think it could be applied to all manner of species. They've co-crystallised drugs with things like benzoic acid, which is a common crystalline substance. I don't see why they couldn't do it with other things.
Thank you, Ian. Well, better bring us to a close with some trivia. Phil, what have you got for us?
Right, well, this month's trivia is inspired by the Pope's decision to step down. So, as you'll probably have heard recently, Pope Benedict has decided that he's no longer physically fit to do the job and he's going to step down. So we'll soon have a new Pope in place. And while the policies of the new pontiff are a subject of speculation at the moment, I'm sure that you'll join us, Chris, in hoping that he doesn't decide to ban chemistry.
Has there been a track record in the Vatican of chemistry bannings then?
One of them came close. Way back in the 14th century, Pope John the 22nd issued a papal bull that actually banned alchemy.
Unless sanctioned by purchasing a licence from the Vatican, presumably.
Well, quite so. Now we get into the detail of it.
Am I right? Is that really what happened?
If you actually look at the papal bull, it was, rather than banning alchemists outright, it was a ban on tricksters or fraudsters, if you like, trying to make some money out of making gold or silver from base metals, which the Pope quite correctly surmised to be impossible, at least by the methods that they were using.
Was it more that he felt that the church was losing out and if he intervened, he might be able to make a bit of dosh for the church?
There was a revenue stream here that could be tapped into. I couldn't possibly speculate on that, Chris. I'm sure his motives were entirely genuine and just wanted to protect the populace from the wiles of these alchemists.
So they had more money to put in the collection pot at collection time.
Well, that was the penalty for being caught as an alchemist or producing gold or silver, was that you had to provide an equal sum of the gold and silver that you had proclaimed to have produced for the papal coffers.
For the papal coffers. That's the operative expression, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed.
And that's where we must leave it for this month. Thank you to the Chemistry World team, Phil Robinson, Ian Farrell and Andrew Turley, and to our guests, Mark Maskell and John Linden. The production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. We'll be back with more cutting-edge chemistry next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.